Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Greek tragedy underway as the Northern European powers squeeze Alex Tsipras' left-wing Syriza government in a way that Nobel economists Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman argue makes no sense from an economic point of view, while the same powers helped the right-wing government in Ukraine restructure its $125 billion in debts as its economy falls apart. James Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, joins us to discuss how the Swiss have refused to help Tsipras, whose government is not responsible for Greece's debts, find the $100 billion rich Greek tax cheats are hiding. Then, with today's announcement by President Obama that diplomatic relations with Cuba will be fully restored on July the 20th, we will look into a potential tsunami of investment from U.S. hotel chains, cruise ship lines, and agribusiness poised to hit the 3,500 miles of pristine beaches, the coral reefs, mangroves, and tropical forests with an influx of American tourists and dollars. Daniel Whittle, a lawyer and senior director of the Cuba program at the Environmental Defense Fund, who has over 15 years' experience working on conservation in Cuba, joins us to discuss growing concerns on the island that economic development has to be balanced with environmental protection. Then finally, we will speak with Rodolfo Espino, a professor of political science at Arizona State University, specializing in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He joins us to discuss the latest polls that have Donald Trump in second place nationally and coming in second in Iowa and New Hampshire. We will explore why, in spite of the widespread condemnation of Trump's shameful racist remarks, he is apparently gaining in popularity with Republican primary voters. And joining us now is James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is currently a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment and a contributor to Forbes, The American Interest, and The Real News Network. And he has a lead and he was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And it does seem there's a huge double standard, clearly, when Northern Europeans are squeezing this Greek government that wasn't responsible for running up all these debts, that made a offer which the Europeans have simply just ignored, saying that they've ruled out any further talks until on fresh bailouts, even though Greece has made a number of concessions, until the country holds its referendum on Sunday. And as I mentioned in the opening, you have to contrast that with the way they're treating the Ukrainian government, where its economy is falling apart, and yet they're willing to restructure its $125 billion in debt. So what do you think is really going on here?
Well, I think the big picture is that the EU has been trying to implement a so-called austerity program for 6 years, and they've insisted on sharp cuts in the budget deficit. Greece has dropped its budget deficit from about 16% of GDP to the point where they're now generating a surplus. But at a certain point, I think last year, the Greek people, suffering from a 40% decline in GDP and 25% unemployment and 60% youth unemployment and just no evidence of any turnaround, the economy continuing to fall this year, finally said, we've had enough. This is a bankruptcy situation. It isn't a short-term liquidity problem that you can squeeze more blood out of the orange here. And I think the new government came in with a kind of mandate to get the EU and the ECB and the IMF, which are their main official creditors, to recognize the fact that they need to reduce the size of the debt burden and not just worry about short-term programs. So that's what's been the subject of endless discussion here, and I think both sides are exhausted and impatient with each other. But the big picture is that we're not talking about a huge amount of money from the standpoint of the overall situation. We're talking about what I think independent observers have concluded is a kind of a class war. Syriza is a left-wing government. That's the political party that took power in Greece in January. And Podemos is another left-wing party that's, you know, rising in power in Spain. The EU is concerned about these leftist populist parties that want to put an end to the austerity programs. They had their way with Ireland. Ireland kind of rolled over when they negotiated their debt program and basically accepted a huge amount of debt and austerity there without much resistance. But, you know, Greece is putting up quite a fight. I think they want to make an example of Greece and just show, you know, you try this again and we're going to make life miserable for you. So we've kind of come to this situation, which is, I won't bore you with the endless details, but the bottom line is Greece is on the verge of, you know, either firing the left-wing government or, you know, and basically accepting the terms, more cutbacks in spending that the EU is imposing. The euro bond, it's actually the euro group within the EU, not just all EU countries, but those that have signed up for the euro as their currency. Or the other extreme would be that, you know, Syriza basically maintains its position and, you know, has to consider how to survive over the next weeks and months.
So is then what's going on here that the European Union, the Troika, the Northern European powers are basically destroying this government and wrecking the Greek economy in order to maintain this policy of austerity that others have accepted? And if they can't simply allow the Greeks to repudiate this failed policy because the contagion would spread, is that what's happening?
I don't think they would intentionally. I don't think they would sign up for, you know, intentionally destroying the Greek economy, but they're not acting in a way that's going to take care of reduced suffering in Greece. They're primarily concerned about their own credibility, and let the Greek people be damned. And to be fair, they, you know, the German population, if they were polled on whether to extend more financial aid to Greece or to accept a debt reduction, would say no. You know, we've had enough. They forget conveniently the fact that Germany was one of the biggest recipients of debt relief, not only at the end of World War I, but also at the end of World War II, you know, in the 1950s, extraordinary amount of debt relief. France, similarly. I mean, most of these countries have had debt restructuring programs. But that's all kind of washed away, and there's a sort of a Calvinist attitude. The Greeks have to pay it. They signed up for it. They agreed to it. You know, basically the problem is there's no bankruptcy court for sovereign governments. If a private company gets into this kind of situation, they can file Chapter 11 like General Motors did. You know, basically restructured its debts. The creditors had to share in the losses, but General Motors, you know, emerged from that functioning entity and now employs more than, you know, directly and indirectly, more than 1 million people. We've gotten rid of debtors' prisons for private individuals and for, you know, companies. We recognize the fact that if you're locked up in a debtors' prison, you can't generate any income. But effectively, this without a substantial reduction in their debt level, Greece is going to be facing a situation where, I have a dog in the background.
No doubting that.
Probably a supporter of the Greek government. You know, they're going to have a difficult time, you know, 5-10 years down the road recovering from this situation and reducing, you know, having any kind of future for their people. So.
Well, let me just again
the situation.
Sure. Let me again remind the audience I'm speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's currently a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment and a contributor to Forbes and the American Interest, and was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. But as I mentioned in the opening, two Nobel laureates in economics, Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, have argued that what's happening to Greece in terms of what the Troika is doing to it makes no sense from an economic point of view. We're not talking about a lot of money. In fact, the latest offer that Tsipras made, which the EU rejected and said, we're not even going to talk to you until after the referendum, is about $29 billion. A package of about $29 billion, and he's making huge concessions. Obviously, it's too late, and nobody's necessarily to defend the behavior of Tsipras and Varoufakis. They have been at least they're non-traditional political leaders, and I think the European club is just not used to that kind of behavior from, but well, this is a failure of diplomacy, and it has nothing to do with economics, as the two Nobel economists say, then it's everything about politics, and that seems unforgivable.
Well, I think one of the themes that they're playing on here is that the Greek people have this horrible experience under German occupation during World War II with hyperinflation, and the Germans came in and to seize assets, they printed lots of drachma. So there was a huge hyperinflation, and essentially for 3 years under German occupation. Many of the pensioners remember that period. So they're not interested in their own currency or return to the drachma. They'd love to stay in the euro. So that's part of what the EU folks are betting on. They're betting on this referendum that would be held on Sunday, a yes vote for staying in the euro. And that would sink the Syriza government, Prime Minister Tsipras and the people who have been resisting this austerity program. So there's a very important vote coming this week, but I suspect that the situation is going to continue for a while. And we're going to see an important election in Spain in the fall. There's just all over Europe, there's impatience with this austerity program.
Right.
The risk is, ironically, in Greece, the Syriza party is one of the most dedicated, fans of democracy and of also of staying in the euro. So they don't want to leave. They don't want to issue their own drachma. But there are others in the economy that are, neo-fascists who want there to be done with the EU. There's quite a few groups all over Europe that are tired of the EU and are threatening to pull out. I mean, one of the largest parties in France is Le Pen's party, National Front, and that's an anti-EU party that's, standing in the wings here. So we're seeing a lot of the same themes that played a role in the 1930s when you had left and right kind of polarize under the impact of the Great Depression. And, Greece has had an economic downturn here that is worse than the Great Depression from the standpoint of their economy. This is producing, I think what the EU doesn't really appreciate is the profound political consequences. Greece is an important geopolitical player. They have an important, position in the Adriatic and bordering Turkey and, Russia and spent a lot of time as a NATO member. Here we are giving the Ukraine billions of dollars of debt relief, and they're not a NATO member. But in this case, we have a political conflict.
A pretty obvious double standard. Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, it seems to me that what we're heading for is such a confusing train wreck. the Greek people don't really know this. Whatever's on this referendum ballot, it'd be pretty hard to decipher. Whatever the deal is, the deals have been changing every day, and even the deals that were just offered now have been rejected by the Troika. So whatever they're going to be voting on will be confusing. Tsipras is saying vote no. At the same time, saying that a no vote doesn't mean we want to get out of the euro, but the Europeans are saying if you vote no, then you're out of the euro. So, what do you think is going to happen? And by the way, the no vote's going down. By the way, the yes vote's going up. Sorry. Go ahead.
As they've been very good at applying the pressure, and as the economic turmoil increases, you know, more people are getting scared. So I think that's the effect that the EU wanted to have. No, I think that there's, it's really hard to say. It's a very close call, but there are measures that Greece could take if they got cooperation from the rest of the EU. I'm an expert on tax havens, and there's at least $100 billion of Greek money that's offshore that's not taxed. I mean, the whole shipping industry is offshore. You have havens like Switzerland and Luxembourg and Cyprus that are, you know, sort of nearby neighbors profiting from this stuff. That would, you know, one of the Syriza's programs was to raise tax enforcement, increase cooperation with tax havens so that they get some of this money back. That was rejected last week. Juncker, who is the head of the EC, presidency, is basically from Luxembourg. I mean, he's a tiny country with 600,000 people and six banks, and there's a lot of political games being played here. I would describe this policy the EU is presenting is not justified by economics, but it's essentially a class war, and it's entirely motivated by this concern about the left.
And if there's $100 billion that Tsipras could collect, he's already said he wants to raise the taxes on the rich, and the Swiss are not helping in any way. That sort of exposes the hand, doesn't it?
Well, I think that's part of the story. You know, the Swiss are not helping. None of these havens are really collaborating in terms of, actually identifying, cooperating with the tracking of this money. And that's just consistent with their behavior in other cases that we've seen throughout Europe where whistleblowers have come forward and reported these accounts. That's where the so-called Lagarde list, in the case of Greece, came up with 2,000 names of very wealthy people with funds in Switzerland, and just haven't had the ability to track it down or to get people to report in. So, it's another example. I mean, I think there is a failed state here, but the failed state is the EU, basically.
Well, James, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, sorry about the dog.
Oh, that's okay. All right. A lot of dog lovers in our audience. Okay, bye-bye. I've been speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is currently a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment and a contributor to Forbes and the American Interest, and was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. We're going to take a brief station break. We're talking about today's announcement that diplomatic relations with Cuba will be fully restored on July the 20th. But at the same time, Cuba is wary of its natural resources being exploited.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice. Bow down and be grateful and say, sure, take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Whittle, who's a lawyer and senior director of the CUPA program at the Environmental Defense Fund. He has over 15 years' experience working on conservation in Cuba and has been doing so full-time since 2009. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Whittle.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And President Obama announced at the White House today plans to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba, and also went on to ask the Republican-led Congress to drop its opposition to reconciling with Cuba and lifting the travel and trade embargoes, which he referred to as relics of the past. And apparently diplomatic relations will be officially restored on July the 20th. Letters have been exchanged between American and Cuban officials, and Secretary of State John Kerry is going to travel to Havana soon to, as he says, to proudly raise the American flag over our embassy once more. So things are moving, right? And you've been working in Cuba for the last 15 years, full-time since 2009. So how does today's announcement strike you?
It's phenomenal. It's a real game changer. President Obama said today that when he announced that the flag would be waving, the American flag would be waving over the embassy in Cuba, he said that's what change looks like. And he's right. It's a big step forward. I've been working in Cuba for 15 years and in earnest for the last 5 or 6 years. And it's remarkable to see the hope on the streets in Cuba, not only with the Cuban scientists and environmentalists that I work with, but just the people on the street. It's tangible. And so I can imagine, I'm going to Havana next week, and I can imagine that there's just a tidal wave of enthusiasm in light of this new development. So it's exciting.
So you use the word tidal wave, and of course, some Cuban scientists have said, including Liliana Nunez-Velez, who's the president of the Antonio Jimenez Foundation for Man and Nature, which is a sort of quasi-independent environmental organization in Havana, talking about the opening to the West, and particularly the United States, this tsunami is coming. And she went on to say, an internal tsunami is asking for consumption, 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 for profit, benefit, and profit. So people in Cuba apparently are a little worried that this flood of expected flood of American tourists and American dollars may impact the country's pristine forests, coral reefs, mangroves, national parks, and its method of agriculture, which has become largely organic.
That's right. The change in relations is a huge opportunity, and it presents new challenges that are unprecedented. In terms of an opportunity, you know, for once, Cuba has a real chance to develop its economy in ways it really hasn't had before. Opening up Cuba to trade with the U.S., you know, offers tremendous opportunities in every sector: tourism, agriculture, you know, mining, services, et cetera. And the challenges are apparent. Cuba's the crown jewel of the Caribbean. It's really a phenomenally beautiful place. You know, hundreds of miles of beaches that are undeveloped, thousands of small keys and islands that are undeveloped, biodiversity that's unparalleled throughout the region. And it's really a remarkable place. There's so much pent-up demand in the U.S. to see Cuba. Everyone I know wants to go to Cuba, wants to hike in its mountains, go to its beaches, et cetera, dive in its coral reefs. And so the trick will be how to grow the economy and protect the environment at the same time. And it's a challenge that the Cuban government's certainly aware of, and there's certainly a debate behind the scenes going on about how to do it, where to strike that balance. But, you know, my impression is that they're up for it, and you know, they're putting measures in place as we speak to get ready for the change. But overall, it's a big step forward for the Cuban people and for their economy.
So there is opportunity and peril, though, isn't there? I mean, they surely don't want to end up looking like Miami Beach.
Well, I wouldn't think so. Some people in Miami might might think otherwise. But, you know, I asked a question to a Cuban friend and government official back in December when the initial changes happened. I said, you know, some people say the embargo is the environment's best friend in Cuba. Is that true? And he said, absolutely not. He said, it certainly has affected our development patterns in the past, but it's also deprived the country of access to environmental technologies, to support from international development funds, and from partnerships with, you know, conservationists like the Environmental Defense Fund and others. So, you know, with an open door, you know, more attention can be paid to, you know, protecting the environment through better technologies, cleaning up polluted waterways, et cetera. So it's a big opportunity, but of course, as you mentioned, there are perils involved.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Whittle, who's a lawyer and senior director of the Cuba program at the Environmental Defense Fund. He has over 15 years' experience working on conservation in Cuba and has been doing so full-time since 2009. And Cuba, of course, has 3,500 miles of coastline, which is largely undeveloped. Some of its Caribbean neighbors are examples, obviously, not to follow. Haiti has all but devastated its environment. Puerto Rico, et cetera, has lots of problems with deforestation, pollution, damaged coral reefs, et cetera. So the lessons are out there to be avoided. But I take it that one of the things that happened to change Cuba into a more green and organic country in many ways was the collapse of the Soviet bloc in 1991, where the country was left to fend for itself. It no longer got discounted oil from the Soviets, and they had to turn, you know, for example, instead of having tractors, they had to have oxen, and they turned into more organic techniques and small farms and co-ops. So is that something that could be threatened? If I know Cargill wants to get in there.
Well, you know, I think that's exactly the right question. Or what's the expression? Crisis is the mother of invention. And that's certainly the case in Cuba. You know, initially they had no choice but to find ways to produce food without pesticides and herbicides. And they were successful. They've now become a model to be emulated for organic agriculture. Urban agriculture's really taken off. They're not there yet. They still have many farm fields that are fallow. There are government programs to encourage farmers to expand production of crops. They still import nearly 80% of their food. So on the one hand, they've created a new model for the Caribbean and for the region for organic agriculture, but there's still, you know, food security concerns. So, you know, how do they become more independent in terms of food production without succumbing to the mistakes that so many places have made, without giving back over to intensive industrial agriculture? That's a question I can't answer, but I know it's on everyone's mind down there. And there's some really good partnerships between U.S. groups and Cuban groups trying to come up with new approaches.
But in your talks with Cuban officials and environmentalists in Cuba, since you've been working there for 15 years, have they brought up, for example, what's happened in China, where enormous economic growth has come at the price of enormous amount of environmental destruction? As you know, in many of the major cities, you can barely breathe the air.
Well, that's exactly right. The benefit that Cuba has that so much of the region didn't have is they've got the benefit of history. They've got, you know, 50 years of lessons about what not to do. And the Cuban government is very close to the governments of Vietnam, of China, the former Soviet Union, Russia. And in China is a perfect example. China ramped up their economy purposefully, relegating the environment to the back seat. And they're now paying the price. Environmental pollution is undermining economic growth in China. That's no secret. That's well known. And, you know, the Cuban, you know, government's aware of that. And I think it's a lesson they're looking at very closely. You know, typically, you know, when a country tries to develop its economy, the environment takes a back seat to economic growth. And I think in Cuba, the environment has been in the passenger seat for a long time. And, you know, our goal is to keep it there. and to, you know, do the best we can to support their efforts to strike the right balance, grow the economy, and protect their just wonderful natural heritage.
So what do you expect to happen then at the 7th Congress of the Cuban Communist Party that's coming up? I take it that these issues are going to be front and center.
Well, yeah, periodically the Cuban government convenes a Congress. This is only the 7th that they've had since the revolution in 1959. My understanding, it will be held next April, and the idea is to chart the path forward. They'll be having a change in leadership in 2018. They'll have a new president. And at the Congress, they will be debating the economic policies, the governance policies, et cetera. So it's an opportunity to chart the course for the future. And there will be so much on the table. The environment will be one of many, many issues. Other issues are how to attract the right foreign investment, how to create conditions that, you know, make American companies from elsewhere, you know, want to invest in Cuba. And so, again, it's going to be a real challenge to attract the right, you know, investors, attract the hotels that, you know, have a record of sustainability, or, you know, golf course developers. There are only 27 holes of golf in Cuba right now. And there's interest from China, from England, from elsewhere to help the country develop golf courses. And there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. So all of these issues are going to be on the table next year.
Well, then we'll see whether Donald Trump shows up there, right? That'll be, I think, the litmus test of the right way or the wrong way.
Well, I'm not sure he's welcome much anywhere these days.
Exactly.
Hopefully not.
But I understand these big cruise ship companies are salivating at the prospect, and Marriott and Hilton hotel chains have already expressed a lot of enthusiasm. So, you know, they're chafing at the bit. What do you think? Are they going to put pressure on the Congress? Because you got Marco Rubio running for president, spouting all kinds of anachronistic nonsense, and Boehner is talking about, you know, what a terrible country Cuba is and how these horrible dictators are destroying. We can't possibly work with them. And, of course, that has little to do with reality, because the American people want to go there. Cubans, Americans go there all the time. So they are out of step, the Congress. Do you think corporate America is going to sort of push them out of the way or ease them out of the way?
You know, that's a great question. And I think if you look at popular support in the U.S. and actually in Cuba as well, there's overwhelming public support for change, for improved relations. And you see that in the U.S. and the business community as well. The head of the Chamber of Commerce has been to Cuba a couple times, is very eager for U.S. businesses to operate in Cuba. You know, the agricultural community would like to trade with Cuba. The tourism and hospitality sectors. So there's it's nonpartisan. We also see several members of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress from the Republican Party, calling for change. Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona is one of several. So I think, you know, Congress is following. The president has done a fantastic job of leading on this issue. He's gone where no one else has gone in, you know, almost 60 years. And I think the horse is out of the barn. So I think, you know, now it's up to Congress to, you know, make the transition work, make it work for the Cuban people, the American people, and, you know, for both of our economies and for the environment, of course.
Well, just in closing, though, you mentioned how attractive and unique the country is, because there are just miles and miles of pristine beaches and reefs and forests that are untouched. So, you know, that suggests ecotourism. I mean, there are a lot of people who want to experience that. And if you just have a land rush, a gold rush of all the big hotels plonking down these huge things like they have on Waikiki Beach and Hawaii, forget about it. You know, it's all over, and you've lost the very thing that's attractive in the first place. So from your dealings with the Cuban authorities and the environmentalists there, do you think they can figure a way to develop but at the same time preserve?
Absolutely. You know, that's certainly the intention. And I think with the more international support they have, the more partnerships they have, they will find a way to do that. I mean, as you mentioned, the Cuban environment is unique in the region. There are coral types of corals in Cuba that haven't been in the Florida Keys for over 50 years. The coral reefs around the island are just plentiful with fish. There are birds that American bird watchers have never seen, so there's a pent-up demand. But there's just a huge opportunity to develop ecotourism in Cuba and again, use that as an economic engine. And I'll just say one more quick thing, is that how well Cuba manages its environment affects us in the U.S. You know, marine life is migratory. They don't observe political borders, from sharks to manatees to sea turtles. So we stand to benefit if Cuba does a good job managing its environment, from its, you know, energy sector to its biodiversity. So there's a lot to be gained. So I think, you know, the more that we can support their efforts, the better off, you know, we'll all be.
Well, Daniel Whittle, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Whittle, who's a lawyer and senior director of the Cuba program at the Environmental Defense Fund. He has over 15 years' experience working on conservation in Cuba and has been doing so full-time since 2009. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how it could be that the racist buffoon Donald Trump, after insulting Latinos, is now polling in second place in the Republican presidential primaries.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, or just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, specializing in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and is the co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rodolfo Espino.
Thank you for having me.
And since Donald Trump made those extraordinarily incendiary and racist remarks when he announced his run for the presidency as a Republican in this crowded field, it's extraordinary that he did it in the first place. And we know about the repercussions. Univision have cut off ties to himself, NBC, and now Macy's have dropped his clothing line. But nevertheless, according to a CNN national poll that was released Wednesday, Donald Trump is polling 12% of GOP primary voters, saying they're most likely to support him in 2016. He's outranking everybody in the Republican field except former Governor Jeb Bush, who garnered 19%. And just while you're absorbing the shock there, Rodolfo, in Iowa, he's coming in second, according to a Quinnipiac poll. And in New Hampshire, he's also coming in second with 11%, second only to, again, Jeb Bush, who is standing at 14%. So how do you explain that?
I would explain this as just this is a temporary artificial media bump. There's just like this shock that has been inserted into the Republican field with Donald Trump saying some of the provocative statements that he had. You know, he's just garnering news attention and name recognition within the Republican base that I just anticipate it's just going to be temporary. He's not going to be able to maintain those poll numbers, I suspect. But one thing to ask is, well, why did he even garner that much support, even though, in my opinion, it's just temporary? And it is a sign of just what the Republican base in certain states consists of, an older white conservative electorate that is not the face of our current country. A candidate like Donald Trump could, in fact, it's not shocking to me that he's losing corporate ties to, you know, to Macy's, NBC, so on and so forth, in 2015, heading into 2016. A candidate like him, though, however, just, you know, move the clock back 10 years ago, would not have received as much backlash as quickly as we're seeing now in 2015. Go back to 2005, here in my own home state of Arizona. Yeah, we have the infamous Sheriff Joe Arpaio, whose statements about Mexican immigrants are not in 2005 were not all too different from Donald Trump is saying in 2015. And in 2005, there were not many repercussions, you know, on the capitalistic side. You know, Sheriff Joe Arpaio still, you know, could say those things and get away with it. Donald Trump could have said those things in 2004 and could have got away with it. Fast forward to 2015, you cannot say such provocative statements and not expect that there's going to be some backlash, in part because corporations recognize that they're, you know, they're interested in the dollar, and there's this growing Latino populace in America that will shift their dollars elsewhere. There's also a growing Latino populace within the American electorate that will shift their votes elsewhere. And that's much different than what we saw even 10 years ago. We now see that corporations are paying attention to provocative statements such as Donald Trump, and you can even see such things, you know, the corollary with respect to the kind of the controversy over the Confederate flag. We saw how quickly certain companies, Amazon, Walmart, said we're not going to sell the Confederate flag anymore, in part because I think the nation's sensibilities have progressed dramatically over this last decade.
But Rodolfo Espino, corporations don't vote. I mean, they are, according to a Supreme Court ruling from the 19th century, they are persons in law, but they don't vote, and people do. And I don't think you can get around the fact that Trump is polling well. He's coming in second in New Hampshire, coming in second in Iowa, and coming in second in a CNN national poll. I still find that extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. And let me come back to why I think this is a temporary bump. There's a lot of research within political science and the general social sciences that studies why humans think the way they do, how opinions can be shifted, but shifted just for, you know, for a temporary moment because of some news effect. So I see this Donald Trump statement as a temporary news effect that's appealing to this certain nativist group within the Republican base, and they do not constitute the majority of the American electorate. That's an important consideration. This is this is a subgroup within the Republican primary voting electorate, and that even that group is going to shift their opinions when another news event comes up. Another candidate is going to say something provocative, and they may shift their loyalties to that other candidate. You know, and again, a lot of research within the social sciences shows that, you know, you have these news effects, and voters have limited ability to recall information that is more than a year, you know, more than a year old. Ability to recall information for voters is going to hinge on the fact of how proximate that information or that event is to election day. So if Donald Trump said something provocative within the week before, you know, November 2016, you know, that would have more of an impact in terms of how Republicans are going to feel towards Donald Trump than the statements that he just made recently about, you know, announcing his candidacy and his view on Mexican migration to the United States. Again, I just see this as an artificial bump. I expect that if we hold this interview again 6 months from now, that Donald Trump will probably not be polling as well in Iowa, New Hampshire as we see right now in July 2015.
Again, I'm speaking with Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, specializing in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and is the co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. So, nevertheless, Rodolfo, I'm struck by the deafening silence of the other Republican candidates. with the exception of Jeb Bush, who didn't make a statement, but in answer to a question from a Spanish language broadcaster, he did say that he didn't approve of that kind of language. But in contrast to that, Ted Cruz came to Trump's defense. I like Donald Trump. I think he's terrific. I think he speaks the truth. I don't think you should apologize for speaking out against the problem that is illegal immigration. I recognize that the PC world, the mainstream media, they don't want to admit it, but the American people are fed up. So it seems to me that this fellow, everybody seems to agree that Ted Cruz, even though he's incendiary and perhaps a demagogue, he's nevertheless a very intelligent person. And you hear that from everybody. So what's their strategy? They can't be simply committing political suicide here. They must think they have a constituency.
Yeah, and they, again, their constituency right now is that Republican base that's going to turn out for the primary, the Republican primary elections. And it's a crowded field. And each, you know, I think we're up to about 16 declared candidates, last count, growing maybe possibly past 20. And each candidate is trying to outdo each other. And I agree with you. I am shocked by the deafening silence on the Republican side in terms of responses to Trump's comments. And I'm even further shocked by Cruz's support of Donald Trump, because Cruz and anybody who's any other Republican candidate who's not going to criticize Trump and say that what he was saying is wrong, in my opinion, are doing so at their own political peril. I do think it's political suicide in 2015, 2016, not to come out with a forceful statement that you do not agree with Donald Trump's characterization of Mexican immigrants, the Mexican electorate here within the United States. You do so at your own peril, because there are going to be spillover effects. It's Mexican voters, of course, are not going to want to support candidates that are not going to take a stance denouncing Trump's statement. And there are going to be other voters, not just Hispanic voters, but white swing voters that are going to, you know, that don't see Mexican migration as a threat as much as the nativist, older, white conservative Republican base do. There is shifting opinion, open minds to people from different backgrounds. People bring, you know, their own experiences, increase the diversity for the better good of America. And I think that Republican candidates, Ted Cruz most notably, will be losing votes come 2016 if they continue to take the side of someone like Donald Trump or someone like Sheriff Joe Arpaio. You know, it's political suicide. Again, returning to my previous comments, you as a Republican candidate could have probably gotten away with some of those statements about 10 years ago. Fast forward a decade later, the country's sensibilities, the electorate has shifted enough in terms of its composition, in terms of its opinions, that you cannot say such disparaging remarks about any group out there without political repercussions.
Well, it's pretty hard to find a way to shame this fellow, though. He says the most outrageous things. He seems like a massive sort of bombastic fraud. A lot of research has been done on the fiction that he's a billionaire. I mean, we don't really know where all of his money comes from, but he doesn't appear to. He actually apparently needed that job at NBC that he just lost, where he has that famous punchline, "You're fired."
Right.
But the stuff that comes out of him, apart from his sort of somewhat ridiculous comb-over, the stuff that comes out of him, you know, like, for example, in response to NBC and Macy's, clearly NBC and Macy's support illegal immigration, which is totally detrimental to the fabric of our once great country. And then he writes this letter to the head of Univision, Randy Falco. "Please be advised that under no circumstances is any officer all representatives of Univision allowed to use Trump National Doral Miami, its golf courses or any of its facilities." And he goes on to say that they're going to close the gate that's being built between the Trump and Univision properties. And by the way, when I become president of the United States, the days of favorable trade deals with the Mexican government will be over. I mean, it sounds like the guy's delusional.
Yes, it does. And if anything, it's probably, you know, observing him over the last several decades, he's the kind of personality that is feeding his own ego and surrounds himself with yes men that are going to just support what he already believes. But again, that is...
By the way, I don't mean to interrupt, but when you say he surrounds himself with yes men, at his announcement that he's running for president, he had to rent a crowd. They were movie extras, paid $50 to stand around and cheer. So that's not being surrounded by yes men. That's being surrounded by props.
Paid men.
Paid men.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it just shows that behind the black curtain, you know, what is really going on with a candidate like Donald Trump. And it's, you know, the ability to self-finance. You know, he has, I mean, there are questions about his real net worth, but he does have billions of dollars at his disposal that he can just increase his public profile that feeds his ego. And, you know, we're seeing other candidates enter the field that probably have access to lots of dollars that will allow them, even though they have no hope in hell to win the presidency, it's an opportunity for them to be out there in the limelight, you know. And it's, in some ways, while we may disagree with Trump's positions, his opinion, his comb-over, it is his right, according to the First Amendment and certain Supreme Court decisions, to spend what he wants to put his opinions out there. And if he's going to want to burn his money on selling opinions that are going to upset millions and millions of voters out there, that actually is his right, according to our Constitution.
Well, but that gets to a key question, Rodolfo Espino, and that is whether or not the Republican Party, particularly when you have Jeb Bush, who speaks very fluent Spanish, is married to a Mexican woman, and he has a son who's also very appealing. And I guarantee you he's going to be on Univision all the way through to November of 2016. He'll be a regular. And Univision, even though they take a strong stance on immigration or against the xenophobic attitude of the right in this country towards immigration, they nevertheless are very conservative and very pro-Republican. So they're all, I imagine, you know, the Jeb Bush camp and the Univision people are wondering, you know, we got to stop this guy before he stops our chances of winning over the Latino vote.
To a certain extent, but you walk a fine line. You don't want to alienate. Again, you have to win the Republican primary before you go to the general election, where Latino voters are going to make more of a difference. So you walk a fine line because you don't want to alienate too much of your white Republican base by taking too strong of a pro-immigration stance. You know, you don't want to be called the open border pro-amnesty candidate, you know, which Donald Trump could easily label Jeb Bush. Oh, he's pro-illegal immigration. You know, and you could probably imagine that negative ad could run. He's pro-illegal immigration because, look, goodness, he's married a Mexican woman. You know, you could have these negative character assassinations that could sink Jeb Bush's chances early on. So he and his advisors, his campaign staff, will probably want to, you know, appear tough on immigration, but not too tough, so that should they win the Republican nomination, they're not alienating a significant block of swing voters in the general election. And those swing voters could come down to the Latinos in certain swing states, such as North Carolina, for instance, Florida, of course. New Mexico is always up. California, and slowly but surely, and Nevada, but slowly but surely, even a state like Arizona, where Latino voters slowly are becoming part of that swing electorate come general election time.
Well, the one Latino candidate running on the Republican ticket, apart from Cruz, who doesn't speak Spanish, by the way, but Marco Rubio does speak Spanish.
Yes.
He's been really disgracefully silent, don't you think?
Yes, he has. But I think, too, probably it's one of those campaign strategies where, look, we're only in July, beginning of July 2015. We're talking more than a year out. The controversy over Trump's statements are going to be forgotten come July 2016, you know, and by then, you know, we'll pretty much know who the Republican candidate is. You know, those dates that candidates have to pay attention to are January, February 2016. So half a year from now, you know, candidates like Rubio, Cruz, will probably want to just hope that another news event inserts itself into the political news cycle and makes this Donald Trump story go away. Their fear, of course, is that Donald Trump, he's a loose cannon. Who knows what Donald Trump is going to say come October, November 2015, that those candidates at that point in time will have to say something. But right now, voters, you know, I'm pretty sure that voters 6 months from now, a year from now, will have forgotten what Donald Trump has said just a month ago.
Yeah, but if these polls hold with him coming in second in a national poll by CNN and coming in second in the important polls in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first debate on Fox is in August. They've set a bar of 10 candidates. So he's going to get on those debates. And and he already said, by the way, well, you know, I think even before he started, he announced he's running, he described Jeb Bush as a complete disaster, as a total zero. I mean, he's been absolutely outspoken in his contempt for Bush. So what else? Well, where else can he go? You know, I mean, isn't that going to be interesting at least to watch?
It'll be fascinating to watch. I mean, it's perhaps, you know, there's an opportunity for one of those political news moments that we're going to be watching on replay 30 years from now. You know, it can reminiscent of Rick Perry's comments where he could not remember the three federal agencies that he wanted to shut down. So it would be fascinating political humor. But, you know, on a serious note, if you're a handler for Jeb Bush, if you're a handler for Cruz, for Rubio, any other Republican candidate, the best tactic is not to take Donald Trump's criticism of you too seriously. Don't appear agitated. You want to appear presidential. Because ultimately, what is going to be the downfall of Donald Trump is going to be Donald Trump. He is his own worst enemy. He's going to shoot himself. He does not appear presidential. His, you know, his announcement that he was running for the presidency was not a presidential speech. He just went off. He's a loose cannon. And frankly, voters, when they think about what kind of leader do they want in the political, you know, in the White House that has their finger on that trigger, they don't want a loose cannon. They want somebody that appears presidential. And so Donald Trump does not appear that. So the best advice for any Republican candidate that is getting attacked by Donald Trump's criticisms would be well advised just to, you know, treat him as a child, you know, that's throwing a temper tantrum, and just appear presidential, appear adult-like. Because that's what voters are ultimately going to prefer than somebody who's going to be throwing that temper tantrum.
Right, and of course he's in the race at any rate, not necessarily to win, which he doesn't have a chance, but he's certainly in there to promote his brand, and the good news is that his brand has suffered, as it certainly should. I thank you for joining us, Rodolfo Espino.
Well, thank you for having me again.
And again, I've been speaking with Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, specializing in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and is the co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.